Welcome back to the Book Club. I'm Michael Knowles. This month we are going to be talking about Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is a book that men and boys in particular don't want to read, but is actually one of the greatest novels of all time. We will get into it. I'm joined by Abigail Schreier, a journalist and the author of the upcoming book Irreversible Damage, due out in June from Regnery. Abigail, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I have to confess, I've read Pride and Prejudice 3 times. First time I read it, I didn't like it. Second time I read it, I still didn't like it. The third time I read it, I loved it. How's that?
It's a work for a mature man. It really is.
Well,
it really
thank you.
Is.
You flatter me.
Anyone who really wants, you know, to see inside a woman's psyche, you know, to get inside her heart and mind, this is the book to do it. And I think that's the sort of thing that can benefit, you know, everyone. I mean, you know, you see this actually, Jane Austen actually deals with that in the book. She sort of ridicules Collins, who's one of the characters in the book, who says, you know, I don't read fiction.
Yeah.
And of course, we watch him spend the rest of the book suffering for the fact that he doesn't care about human relations. Relationships, and he's left with obsequiousness, and you know, slavish devotion is the only arrow in his quiver.
Can you very quickly? Obviously, this is a very complex novel, but can you very quickly give a summary? The novel begins with one of the most famous lines in literature. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighborhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters.
I mean, that's what's so amazing about it, right? It's obviously tongue-in-cheek. There's real wisdom in it, too, because there's truth in it. I mean, Jane Austen is full of these nested truths. Look, this is the story of the 5 Bennet girls and their family, and they are facing calamity in the, you know, countryside of England. And the calamity is that their estate has been entailed through the male line, which means the property rules governing their estate mean that it can only be inherited by males. In their family. So they're about to lose, when their father dies, they will lose their house, they will lose everything. And they are facing poverty in 19th century England. They are facing, we're talking about nothing like we could imagine today, starvation, disease, early death. So they are up against formidable odds, and the only person really in a position to save them is Elizabeth Bennet. And she does it through her wit, her intelligence, her deep moral sensitivity and thoughtfulness, and her thoroughgoing rationality.
So Elizabeth Bennet is the second eldest of the daughters. The eldest is Jane. She's the most beautiful. She's like the prom queen. And Elizabeth is a little tougher.
Right. She's the most judgmental.
Most judgmental, most prejudiced.
Right. I don't know if I'd call her the prom queen, because Jane is actually very deep as well and has a lot of wisdom. What she has is a lot of acceptance and forbearance. She really is willing to roll with what life hands her.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth very much is not, and this is why she's our heroine. She's every bit the heroine of Odysseus or Aeneas or Robinson Crusoe. But what she battles, of course, her theater is not war, right? But it's a different sort of war. It's a war in the English countryside of balls and homes, in which she must fight for the opportunity to secure her family through marriage.
Because she's got this, you might say, nagging mother. The mother has the best interests of her daughter, I think, somewhere at heart, which is she's trying to marry off her daughter. She's constantly trying to encourage the daughters to get married. She's got this sort of absent father who indulges his daughters. He's not paying close attention. And then these rich guys come to town. You've got the rich guy, Mr. Bingley, who's very affable, nice guy. And you've got the rich guy, Mr. Darcy, who is the most important male character in the novel. And Darcy is rude, he's prideful, he's judgmental, he doesn't make a good first impression. And yet by the end of the novel, spoiler alert, Elizabeth Bennet ends up with Mr. Darcy, and their prejudices have been smashed, as has their pride.
Right, and they reach a point of mutual admiration and love. You're absolutely right. She's saddled with a fool for a mother, an ineffectual and distant father, and she has to save the entire family, and she does. It's funny. In certain ways, the book seems archaic, right? We don't go to balls anymore, and women aren't judged in this way. Well, anyone who would say that really isn't paying attention, of course, because of course they are. There's a ball that never ends, and we call it social media, and Caroline Bingley always shows up. Yeah. You can never escape her. We know what she thinks because she tells all her friends, all your friends.
So Carolyn Bingley is the sister of this rich guy.
And she's mean.
And she's cruel.
She's
and
cruel.
Awful
and she makes, right, and in this game for social status and social acceptance, she is devastating. And she fights with all the, you know, classic female tools of ostracism and, you know, rumor and all, you know, and put downs of various kinds and social slights. And this is what happens to young girls on social media every day. The only cruel thing about it is they can't escape.
Right.
And they never need wonder sort of how much less pretty they are than the next girl. So if social media provides the math, right? You just subtract the likes.
Well, this is what really got me to start appreciating Pride and Prejudice is that it is mostly about women. It's about this the desires of women and the status of women, but it's so full of action. Even though nothing really happens. It's so rich in tension and drama and action, but it's about the private lives in this private sphere and dinners and teas and balls of these girls in the English countryside.
I mean, that's exactly right, right? High school boys denigrate it. They say, oh, nothing happens, right? We want the Iliad. We want battles.
We want adventure.
Yeah. Right, but what are the battles of our lives? Mm-hmm. They're mostly social, right? They're mostly about people who don't like us or don't esteem us or try to keep us out or try to hold us back or try to keep us down. Those are the real battles of the modern life. Mm-hmm. And they're the battles that Elizabeth must fight.
And it's a very serious work in the sense that it's all taking place, talking about people's manners and how polite or rude they are and a little biting comment here or there. But really, the novel isn't just about manners. It's about virtue. You know, the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, who wrote another great book called After Virtue, he said that Jane Austen, in Pride and Prejudice and other books, is the last great imaginative voice on the subject of virtue. Everything in this book keeps coming down to virtue. You know, she even says, when she's concluding what makes a marriage work, she says, how little of permanent happiness could belong to a couple who were only brought together because their passions were stronger than their virtue. This idea of virtue keeps coming back, and it comes back to the very title of the book, which is Pride, the Queen of All Vices, and how virtue can be contrasted with that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, too often this book gets dismissed. I think because it is about things like virtue, it's about human relationships. Oh, who cares about those, right? Yeah. They're only the most defining features of our lives, right? Oh, marriage, that's not a consequential decision, right? Women should care more about what? Their careers? I mean, what are the things that matter most to us? It's the relationships we have with people. Mm-hmm. That is what makes life worth living, right? I mean, would we admire Elizabeth Bennet more if she spent her life defending the international copyright of Pizza Hut? Is that a better, you know, well, is that more valorous?
That's what modern society says.
Right. That's what modern society says. And how ridiculous is that?
Right.
What she cares about is the things that so many women have cared about for so long and are the most important things, which are love, relationships, marriage, children, all sorts of, you know, virtue, all the things that matter most are the things that so many women have naturally cared about and are too often denigrated today.
And it's not merely a complacent book about women's private lives, right? It's a book about these women overcoming social stigma, overcoming scandal, overcoming foolish parents, and ultimately overcoming the self. What's so striking about this, something I think high schoolers often miss, is the centrality of self-knowledge. I think maybe the most famous line in the book, or at least in the top five, is when Elizabeth realizes that she misjudged Mr. Darcy. She misjudged so much of this situation. She prejudged it. She let her pride get in the way. And she says, how despicably I have acted. I, who have prided myself on my discernment. I, who have valued myself on my abilities. Who have often disdained the generous candor of my sister and gratified my vanity in useless or blameless mistrust. How humiliating is this discovery, yet how just a humiliation. Had I been in love, I could not have been more wretchedly blind, but vanity, not love, has been my folly. Pleased with the preference of one and offended by the neglect of the other, on the very beginning of our acquaintance, I have courted prepossession and ignorance and driven reason away where either were concerned. Till this moment, I never knew myself.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's why we love her. She's not perfect, yeah. but the expectations for women that Jane Austen had could not be higher, mm-hmm. right? They are absolutely, I mean, we see the fool that her, what happens to her foolish sister who runs off with the first guy who's interested.
Who is not of the best character, you might say that, fella.
Who's not of the best character, who has had a poor education mm-hmm. And has never managed any kind of self-governance. And Pride and Prejudice takes a very hard stand against that.
Yeah.
It sets very high expectations for these women, and they deliver. I mean, Elizabeth certainly does. And we admire her for that, and with using humor and wit and a lot of, as you said, self-consciousness.
Yeah.
She really succeeds in the end.
Because at this moment where the younger sister, Lydia, who is a flirt, that's how she's described. She always wants to be surrounded by these men and flirting with them, and she runs off with this shady character who on the surface is very charming and nice and seems like an upright guy, and in reality he's rotten to the core. So they run off together, and the other sister, Mary, who is kind of like the moralizer of the book, she reflects on this and says, loss of virtue in a female is irretrievable, that one false step involves her in endless ruin. Her reputation is no less brittle than it is beautiful. She cannot be too much guarded in her behavior toward the undeserving.
But I don't think Jane Austen takes that view.
No.
Right?
This is the prevailing view the time.
At the time, right. So Jane Austen's view is much deeper, I think,
right.
Because Mary's very awkward. She doesn't read social cues. Mm-hmm. One gets the sense from the beginning she may be an old maid. She really has struggles with people. And she comes across as way too censorious and mm-hmm. way not, and certainly not understanding enough. Yes, I think that's right. I mean, in a certain sense, what you said about Lydia is she's the modern woman,
yeah.
right? She goes to live. She doesn't care about marriage. She's going to run off with a few.
She's going to go shack up with this guy, live in sin.
Fine.
Yep.
And the problem is, of course, she's facing the ruination of her dignity, her virtue, and her social status, and really financially of her whole family.
Yeah.
And for a guy who probably will never, in fact, he tells us, we'll never get around to marrying her. He has no intention of doing so.
No.
But she goes to live with him anyway. This is not, you know, her future is not so bright.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, she's the modern woman in the book. And Elizabeth Bennet, who fights for her dignity, who withholds. I mean, imagine if Elizabeth Bennet had hooked up with Darcy when she first met him at the first ball, there'd be no book. Right.
Right.
Because he has no esteem for her in the beginning. He'd have no esteem for her in the end.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have won anything. I mean, we all win by withholding.
Yes,
right?
Because at the first moment that our two main characters meet, Elizabeth and Darcy, they don't particularly care for one another. Darcy says that Elizabeth's kind of ugly, not that impressive. Elizabeth finds him haughty and prideful and awful. And they both win each other over through these deeds of virtue. You know, it's interesting, even on her sister Mary's point about virtue being lost in a woman, the woman's lost forever. That doesn't seem to be Jane Austen's view.
Yeah.
But Elizabeth does take it seriously enough that they are doing everything they can to win back this sister and not have her become disreputable for the rest of her life. And this is another key difference in the book between appearance and reality. So the appearance of having a lot of virtue and the reality and really possessing virtue, the appearance of being charming and amiable,
right.
But it's often the most charming characters are the most rotten.
Yes. This is a book against empty charisma,
yes.
I think. No, but that's exactly right. I mean, you know, Kitty is facing nothing good.
Mm-hmm.
Lydia is facing nothing good. And a lot of the reason is because she's a fool, right? She hasn't thought, she hasn't really given much thought to the life she wants. She's not a moral agent.
Right.
And Jane Austen wants women to be moral agents,
yes.
to choose their life, to
yep.
to decide what kind of man they want to end up with, or woman, you know, whoever it may be, and make a decision and go for it. And not by giving in to every whim.
Mm-hmm. And to be a deep, an old soul, a serious person, she draws the parallel to her parents, to Elizabeth's parents, who have this kind of unhappy marriage. You know,
that's
the father's
right.
checked out, the mother is a lunatic. And she attributes this unhappy marriage to just giving in to passion, not disciplining yourself. She writes, her father, this is Elizabeth's father, the parents, captivated by youth and beauty and that appearance of good humor which youth and beauty generally give had married a woman whose weak understanding and illiberal mind had very early in their marriage put an end to all real affection for her. Respect, esteem, and confidence had vanished forever, and all his views of domestic happiness were overthrown. To his wife he was very little otherwise indebted than as her ignorance and folly had contributed to his amusement. It's a pretty harsh burn. This is not the sort of happiness which a man would in general wish to owe to his wife.
So I think this is Jane Austen's answer to the man who says, oh, fiction isn't for me. Who cares about love? That's a woman's thing to worry about. Really? I mean, look what a mess this man has made of his life.
Yes.
Because of it.
Yes.
He now is about to lose his family. They are all going to suffer poverty after him. He's suffering. Mm-hmm. And he's with a woman he doesn't respect or love, really.
Right.
And it was all his doing by thinking he was too good to think about relationships, to think about love, to think about, you know, morality. I mean, he's indifferent, and now he's suffering for it.
Why does the book endure? Why? I mean, it seems to be such an affront to modernity. You know, it seems like all the kind of modern, maybe feminist.
Yeah.
Why on earth do people still read this?
That's a brilliant question, because the question is, right, why would women, and women love this book, you know, people love this, but women love this book.
Yeah.
Why would we love a book that's pre-suffrage, right, pre-feminism, you know, pre-equality, these things? And I think the answer is, because while we have gained so much in modern life, women have gained so much, we also recognize that there are things we have lost. We recognize that Darcy, if he exists, would never marry her today. He would just string her on forever. And that's the recognition. That's sort of that's what we're missing. That's what women don't have today. And this novel is a first glimpse at how to get there and a good reminder of what was, that we shouldn't be so quick to give up.
It reminds me of studies that you see that over the past 50 years, this always puzzles modern pundits, because they say women's happiness should have increased. They are materially so better off. They have all these political rights now. And yet their happiness, both in absolute terms and relative to men, have declined sharply. And they say, why on earth has this happened? And it seems to me what you're suggesting is this gives us a glimpse that really our happiness is not going to be measured by some political slogan or by some material good. It's going to be measured by something deeper, more private, more spiritual, more of greater bearing to the interior life.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you see that they do these studies in Sweden. Why do women still not go into STEM fields as often in Sweden or in these Nordic countries? And they don't, because women actually have preferences. And you can belittle their preferences. You can tell them they all need to be in STEM. They all need to be coding. But actually, there are things women prefer. Not every woman wants to be Jeff Bezos, right? For some reason, right? Every woman is being chastised. We need to lean in more. Stop spending time with your children. Well, women actually have things that they prefer, and they aren't necessarily what men prefers, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, even that difference between the public, you know, being the CEO of Amazon, right, and the private, so much of the novel, not only does it take place in over teas and dinners and walks in the garden, so much of it takes place in letters.
Right.
This private, personal correspondence.
When I read it, I automatically think of my time with my best friend in college. All the things we would discuss. How could she date him? Yeah. We like our friend. How could she fall for such a guy, a horrible guy? What a loser he is, or whatever. And reconciling that and trying to understand, learning, you know, starting out very judgmental and learning to be a little less judgmental. Mm. That's it. It's such an important process for a young woman. And it gives you so much. Those friendships are so important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they do these studies every decade or so. They ask, you know, men who their best friend is. Most men name their wives. And they ask women, and most women name another woman.
Yeah.
And the reason is because women excel at friendship. We're really good at it. And it's really important to us. And we tend to favor very often people jobs that focus on relationships.
Right.
You know, we like writing novels, you know, and we love reading them. And that's just something that we should really stop denigrating so much.
Of course. And it even strikes me that one's prejudice approaching the book, which is that this will be some frivolous, I mean, men don't like reading novels anyway, but there really won't be much of value to it. By the end, even the prejudice of the reader is changed, because you realize you're dealing with a work, in a way, of moral philosophy, and certainly a work of deep gravity and probing of human nature.
I think so. I think every man out there who, you know, maybe didn't like it in high school should give it another shot. And every woman should read it for just for the tremendous pleasure of it.
If for no other reason, that it will give us finally some glimpse into the absolutely inscrutable female psyche, which is practically very useful.
Yes, it is.
Abigail, thank you so much for being
here.
Thank
you.
We could go on forever, but we've got to go on this episode of The Book Club. Be sure to tune in next month. In the meantime, I'm Michael Knowles. Happy reading. Thank you so much for watching this episode of The Book Club on PragerU. PragerU is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so we rely on donations from viewers like you to keep this content on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution today to help keep this content coming. Thank you very much.